This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Access to affordable housing in the Triangle is taking a hit in the very near future. General Services Corporation, or GSC, owns most of Chapel Hill and Carrboro's affordable housing, and this summer they've decided to no longer accept Section 8 vouchers. 9 apartment complexes in southern Orange County are going to be affected by this decision. B.B. Smith is a professor of social work and psychiatry at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. She joins me now to talk about the impact of these cuts to Section 8 housing in Carrboro and Chapel Hill. B.B., welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So what does this mean? This landlord owns 9 complexes. Mm-hmm. They have been obligated under an agreement they signed to offer affordable housing under Section 8.
Yes.
That contract expired. Mm-hmm. And they said, we don't want to do this anymore.
Yes.
So what does that mean for the people who have those Section 8 vouchers and are living in those complexes now?
So that means that many people who are low income and quite a few people who are disabled are going to have to find another place to live. And in Orange County, we've already got significant challenges in helping people find housing. And the way that I think about it is that sort of having a safe place to live is kind of the base of everything else, our health, our mental health. And so it's going to be very disruptive, very stressful. I think when somebody has to move into a new place, we've got sort of the challenges of finding that place and then the challenges of actually moving and getting deposits paid and things connected, and that requires money. And lots of people who are in the situation don't have savings and resources that will help them through that move.
And your search is very narrow because you're looking for some other available Section 8 housing, right?
That's correct.
So you're not going to find too much of that in Carrboro or Chapel Hill, I understand. I mean, 9 complexes represents the majority of the Section 8 housing in those in Orange County.
Yes.
There's not much there to begin with.
There's not much there to begin with. And these complexes that are owned by GSC Corporation were really the apartment complexes that we went to most because they were affordable and they were willing to take Section 8. There have been other complexes in Chapel Hill that have, over the past few years, decided not to participate in the Section 8 program anymore. There's also a complex that's a large complex that rents to people with Section 8 that flooded on June 30th, and all of the first floor apartments were condemned. So that's another group of people that are displaced. So it's really going to be a pretty significant challenge for people who need housing assistance in Orange County.
So they're most likely, or very likely, to move outside of Orange County?
I think that's one of the options that they're going to be looking at. I would imagine that a lot of people will be looking over to Durham, which is that close neighbor. We do have some people in the community who are going to be trying to work with private landlords who aren't big parts of big corporations to see if they can do some persuasion, if they might be willing to rent to more Section 8 recipients.
Now, you specifically work with people with disabilities in this area. What are their baseline needs in terms of housing, in Section 8 housing?
Yeah. So I primarily have worked with people with psychiatric disabilities, with severe mental illness. And generally, most of them are disabled and can't, maybe can work part-time, but can't work full-time. They need to have affordable housing. And the Section 8 vouchers, because when someone gets disability benefits, if they don't have a significant work history, they're eligible for supplemental security income, which is $710 a month. So if you think about coming up with a budget that's going to let you live, rent an apartment, buy your food, pay for utilities, those things, you can think about how challenging that is. So what Section 8 has been able to do for many people with disabilities is to allow them to be in independent living situations. They've just made it affordable. So they might still have a very tight budget, but they can do it. Lots of those folks might need sort of minimal supports to maintain their independent living status. And that's also sort of the preferred situation, is that they're sort of living in integrated settings in the community.
Well, talk a little bit more about that. It is, mm-hmm. to some degree, an integrated setting, although it is, I suspect, somewhat segregated by income.
Yes.
But otherwise, you're living with people who are not disabled and have a greater variety. So there's more integration.
Yes, yes. So that's one of the benefits of the Section 8 vouchers, is that they are integrated more broadly into the community. Some of the other subsidized housing projects that people I've worked with live in, are supported housing apartment complexes, maybe specifically for people with mental illness. And the federal government is moving away from those kinds of facilities because they're saying that that's not true community integration. People shouldn't be sort of segregated with other disabled people. There are also complexes for people who are elderly. And apparently it's still okay for those folks to live in congregate settings. And those are actually some really nice options for low-income elderly folks.
And when you talk about people moving and, again, looking for more Section 8 housing, I mean, when you think about Section 8, the word waiting list comes to mind immediately. You're not just going to go move to Durham even if that was your first choice
right.
and find a place, right? I mean, what is the waiting period? And do you go back on the list? Do you go back on the waiting
right.
list?
Right. Well, and I think that we could probably get some clarity from May on at least what should happen with a Section 8 voucher. They are supposed to be transferable between counties, but there a lot of that is kind of a complicated process. Dealing with any of the housing assistance, you're dealing with sort of multiple bureaucracies that can get complicated for the individual. Lots of the folks I've worked with have needed assistance with navigating that.
Well, let me bring Mai Nguyen into the conversation now. Mai Nguyen is a professor of city and regional planning at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Mai, welcome. Good
Hi.
To have you here.
Happy to be here.
Tell us a little bit about that in terms of Section 8 housing and the overall availability and what happens to a person who gets a notice that says, and essentially, they won't get a notice saying they're evicted. They'll get a notice most likely saying their rent is going up. They no longer qualify under this program. I mean, what will happen?
Well, if their rents go up and they're still within what HUD calls the fair market rents, then they can stay. But clearly in this situation, the rents will be out of line with what HUD is willing to pay. And so they have to move and find other places that will accept these vouchers. And there aren't a whole lot of places that will accept these vouchers. So either they have to have an advocate who can work with a landlord to get them into the process of accepting this, or they move to a place that currently accepts it. And so if they move to Durham, they would have to get the Durham Housing Authority to approve this because it's in a different county. But there are also time limits. There's, the vouchers might expire within 60 or 90 days. And so if they can't get this all done within that time period, then they lose their voucher. And then what happens? They could go and find affordable private market rentals, which are typically substandard oftentimes, or they can move in with other family members or friends, which causes housing overcrowding. So there are a lot of ramifications when people lose their Section 8 vouchers.
And maybe we should explain briefly how this works. You've got a voucher and it says you qualify under this program called Section 8 of the housing legislation. It says essentially that you will pay a certain percentage of your income, whatever that is, and that's going to be a fixed number. And then the federal government is going to pick up the rest of that between that and a fixed number, a fair market number. And then you as the landlord have agreed to accept that. So I'll accept the number. Government's going to subsidize, pay the rest between your percentage and that number that we've agreed on.
That's right. On average, households pay 30% and then HUD pays 70%. And that 70% is guaranteed to landlords. Every month they get a check, it's paid for. So there is this guarantee, and it's a very appealing guarantee for some landlords.
Some landlords, but if you're in a city like if you're in Carborough Chapel Hill, for instance, where real estate is at a premium, I would think that. My question is, who is a Section 8 landlord? Why does anybody get into this? Particularly if you're in a place like Chapel Hill or Carborough, where real estate is pretty dear.
Right. I think in places where they have high vacancies, it might be an incentive for them to accept Section 8 vouchers. So in places where they don't have that problem with vacancies, maybe they're less inclined to take Section 8 vouchers. And so Chapel Hill and Carborough, which are tight housing markets that can rent at very high rates, they might not want to go through the hassle of filling out the paperwork, getting their housing inspected by the housing authority, and that sort of thing. And so there's less of an incentive for them to do so.
There's also an incentive at the front end, isn't there, for the developer? For instance, if you were building new housing and you came in under this program, there might be some guaranteed lower interest rates or favorable interest rates for development. Is that still part of the program?
So there are different programs that incentivize developers. The Section 8 project-based program actually says that certain a certain amount of units within the building will receive Section 8 vouchers. And so they're guaranteed that they're going to fill up certain amounts of units. So that's an incentive. We have another program called the Low Income Housing Tax Credit. So developers get a tax credit from the government if they build some affordable units within their private market development. It doesn't have to be all of it. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. It's mixed income. So there are different ways to incentivize private developers to get into the affordable housing business.
And as a landlord, you sign an agreement with the government for a fixed period of time. Typically, how long is that?
Typically 20 to 30 years.
So you sign an agreement, you say for 20 or 30 years, I'm going to do this, I'll accept this Section 8 housing. And then it's fair. I mean, not to demonize the corporation. They signed an agreement and the 30 or 20 years is up. And everybody knew going into that they just might come out from under this agreement.
I think everybody knew that they would come out from under this agreement. But we couldn't have predicted that we have a housing crisis today the way that we do. So I think that at the time when they developed these programs, they thought, well, you know, it's going to get better. Times are going to get better. We're not going to have these housing issues. But in fact, they're worse now.
And we'll talk more about that, how they are worse, why they are worse, and what can be done to make it better on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. We're talking about cuts to Section 8 housing in the Triangle. B.B. Smith is a professor of social work and psychiatry at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Mai Nguyen is a professor of city and regional planning at UNC Chapel Hill. And our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today talking about changes in affordable housing in this area, Section 8 housing in particular. I've been talking with B.B. Smith, a professor of social work and psychiatry at UNC Chapel Hill, and Mai Nguyen, a professor of city and regional planning at UNC Chapel Hill as well. I'm going to talk a little bit more about what's been happening in terms of housing just over the past in this recession. Businesses are recovering. What's the situation with regard to homelessness and housing, affordable housing, Mai, in this region, in the Triangle?
You know, there are, because of the federal budget cuts, even before sequestration, there was less money going to cities and going to nonprofit organizations to address homelessness issues and housing issues. And so there were already pressures on these organizations, and they were doing less. Or they started partnering with other organizations to fill the gap that federal funding was not providing. And so either they've provided less housing, or they've innovated in different ways. And there are examples in Durham of these partnerships, these innovative partnerships. For example, Self Help, which is a nonprofit credit union, actually, they've worked with Duke University in helping them to build affordable or moderate income housing for working class populations. And so you see these sorts of small innovations happening, but there's also been less supply of housing in general. So across the board, what you see now in places like Durham is there's going to be 7 new apartment complexes that are being built. And so there was this undersupply of housing. And now the rentals that are being built are actually higher end rentals. So it'll fill that niche. But still, the affordable housing supply is still undersupplied.
Well, right, you now talked about the example of Self-Help here in Durham working with Duke to develop, and this was an investment process, so it involves nonprofits at the building end, but not in terms of the financing. This suggests that slow money might be one answer. GSE Corporation can't be expected to tell its investors that they told their investors, we're going to get the highest return. The minute they could get a higher return, they had an obligation to those investors. So that means that at that end of the finance spectrum, we can't expect much in terms of developing low-income housing. Mm-hmm. Is there a slow money answer to this? Investment that doesn't demand as high a return, that could actually build the housing stock and also help subsidize the existing stock?
Absolutely. I think that Self-Help has the mission of helping low-income households. And so their mission is to not make a profit. Now,
or as big a profit. They need to stay in business,
profit.
Right?
That's right. Yes. They need to stay afloat, right? So, and these private developers have a different mission. And so I think maybe building up these organizations like self-help, providing them with loans, low interest loans, so that they can build more affordable housing. This is definitely a model that works, and we could scale this up if there were patient investors.
And somehow coordinated, because mm-hmm. I think they're out there. It's just getting them all together. Bibi, mm-hmm. you know, you work with people with, as you said, psychiatric disabilities. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a feeling abroad, particularly most recently with this legislature, if we cut back benefits, if we cut back unemployment benefits, it forces people into the workplace and it'll all be more productive. I'm just wondering what happens to people with disabilities requiring Section 8 housing. Yeah. The added pressure now of cutting back on their housing mm-hmm. subsidy, how marketable that makes them yeah. and the impact that has on their ability to get back in a workplace or yeah. get into a workplace.
Well, it's already been really difficult in our tough economy that we've had for the past several years. Many people who are disabled want to work, but it's been very hard. They've gotten crunched even more in a tight job market. It's that it's harder for people with a disability, particularly if it's somebody who might look a little different or communicate a little bit differently, even though they might be very skilled and very intelligent. It's really hard for them to get hired. So I think they've kind of got a double whammy now. I think it's been even harder. You know, when employers have their pick of job applicants, they are not that likely to pick the disabled person. It's just sort of a real conundrum.
Well, I'm just wondering what impact it has on your stability, your ability. If you're thinking about where I'm going to move and I've got to reapply now to Durham and I've got to yeah. hope that they're going to accept my voucher and I'm going to hope yes. that they do it in time.
It's incredibly destabilizing and stressful. And our understanding of most severe mental illnesses now is that they are related to stress, that many have a stress component. So these kinds of stressors will really destabilize someone psychiatrically. And I have seen people lose their housing, be evicted, you know, after they have developed psychiatric symptoms. And they've been able, once they've sort of gotten back into treatment, they've been able to put things back together, but it can be very, very disruptive. And really having that stable housing is really just a base for everything else.
We're talking a lot about the loss of Section 8 housing for low-income families. And, of course, it's always been a struggle to provide adequate shelter for people living on the margins. Sequestration has made things even worse. Colin Campbell has been looking at the cuts to Section 8 housing at Raleigh's Housing Authority. Raleigh's Housing Authority made a decision to make some cuts in a different way than many of the surrounding jurisdictions. Colin Campbell's a reporter for the News and Observer and joins us now. Hello, Colin.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me on. The city of Raleigh, Raleigh Housing Authority, has gotten this notice from the federal government about sequestration, which pretty much every housing authority that handles Section 8 in the country has gotten, basically saying that they're going to get what amounts to about a 10% cut in their Section 8 funding for the rest of the year. For Raleigh, that's about $1.6 million. Over in Durham, that's about $2 million for the Section 8 program. And each of these housing authorities is given their own choice as to how to go about making that cuts. In Raleigh, what they've done is they've gone through, and as these contracts are up for negotiation with the landlords that are participating, they're giving them a significant drop in their rent payments. I talked to one guy over in Southeast Raleigh who'd been getting $850 a month for his Section 8 rental. Now he's being offered $762. So he's given a choice. Does he want to stay in the Section 8 program or does he want to give his tenant 30 days to move out and find another property and drop out of the program, similar to the larger company over in Orange County has done? So they've done it that way. Durham has opted to freeze new admissions into the Section 8 programming, so their already long waiting list is just going to get longer. Already about 2 years, it's going to get longer since they won't be able to admit about 200 new people to the Section 8 program as they have in the past.
Did you get a sense, you talked to one landlord, generally speaking, what landlords are going to do in Raleigh under those circumstances?
You know, they're really having to look at the market around them because they've got to decide, you know, does that rent payment, taking that going to give them less money than if they just went into the open market and tried to rent to someone who's able to pay the full amount of their own rent out of pocket? So I think some will definitely opt to drop out, that it's too early at this point to tell just what the numbers are as far as the number of people dropping out of the program. The housing authority sounds fairly confident at this point that they'll be able to rehouse most of the people who end up displaced by the sequestration cuts.
Mainuan, tell us a little bit about this. First of all, Colin's saying that they're going to drop out or opt out of the program. Now, I thought we were going to sign this 20 or 30 year agreement. Well, how can they opt out?
So there's two Section 8 programs. One is the place-based or the actual unit, the actual development, and that's that stays there. But then individuals can get a voucher. And with this voucher, they can rent in the private market. And that's what Colin, I think, is talking about here, is that these are individual vouchers that are portable, that can be moved around. And so when your lease is up, the landlord can say, you know what, I'm no longer participating in this program. You're going to have to find another place to live.
What about that decision to essentially offer landlords, I think it's somewhere roughly within in the range of $100 less a month. How does that compare with what other jurisdictions are doing?
You know, in other places like Durham and Charlotte, they have opted to make those cuts in other places, and things like not hiring new staff with open positions. And they have not dealt with it by paying less money to landlords. And so this has some ramifications. You know, what typically happens in these cases is that the landlord will say to the tenant, if I'm not going to, I'm getting $100 less, you can either make up that $100 or you're going to have to move out. And a lot of times the tenant wants to stay there and they can't afford to move out because the costs of moving out are very high for them. And so they end up bearing the burden of the higher rents.
Colin, you said the Raleigh Housing Authority says they're confident they're going to get people placed. Does that mean there's a lot of housing stock or a lot of this kind of Section 8 ready housing available? And sort of how would that compare to the waiting list? That might be one way to test the availability of this housing stock.
Yeah, the issue is, I think, from what I understand, less the availability of the housing stock, particularly in Raleigh, just because it is such a huge city and there are a number of landlords that are willing to participate, but just the sheer number of vouchers that they're able to offer. So they have a limited number that the federal funding allows them to offer. So you've got this long waiting list in pretty much every jurisdiction, and it's just a matter of being able to find the right place. And, of course, a lot of people may be displaced from their neighborhood of choice. Obviously, there are certain parts of the city that have a high concentration of Section 8 housing and others that don't. So some people may find themselves having to uproot their kids from schools, move to the opposite side of Raleigh if that's where the Section 8 vouchers are being accepted.
You get the sense that there is some mobilization against this decision. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, a lot of the landlords here in Raleigh are really upset. And what they're primarily upset about is just the way the changes were made. They feel like the Raleigh Housing Authority did not seek any input, have any sort of public hearings to decide between this measure for dealing with the sequestration cuts or doing something like Durham did with freezing the admissions to the program, and they wanted to have a role in that. Also, people in certain neighborhoods feel like they're getting cut perhaps disproportionately from some of the higher-income, wealthier neighborhoods of town that also accept Section 8 vouchers. The Housing Authority says that's not the case, but it's hard for these people to sort of accept the fact that their rents are going to go down just this dramatically, and they're going to have to figure out how their business and their rental housing investments are going to be impacted by this change.
My, the impact is more imminent when you have the vision of someone being told that if they don't come up with an extra $100, they have to move, and so they do. It's imminent. But in the case of Durham, for instance, if you simply expand the list, the waiting list, that means those people, that's an extra number of people who won't get into that housing. Is there much of an effective difference?
Yeah, I mean, I think that in one situation in Raleigh, it's displacement, and that's very disruptive, right? Moving people, moving children out of their schools, perhaps, forcing them to put down payments down. That's much more disruptive than saying we're not going to accept new people into the Section 8 program.
And Bibi, I guess that is something we didn't even talk about, because mm-hmm. every time you move into a new place, there are all those initial costs that you have to pick up again.
Exactly.
And you can wait a long time for those deposits to come back from the previous place.
Exactly. And sometimes they don't come back. And anyway, and I think one of the things that's been particularly just alarming to me over the past couple of years as I've sort of gotten involved with the Orange County Partnership to End Homelessness is that we've got quite a few people who are living outside. and right there in the middle of Chapel Hill, in places that you wouldn't know that there's somebody living in the woods or living in the crawl space of a house or, you know, those kinds of things. And that's been something, you know, I've been in the Chapel Hill area, at least working there for the past 20 years. And there's a big increase in that kind of seeing people on the street who are clearly homeless. I think we're just seeing more of that.
Well, and it hasn't translated into, for instance, more shelters. There was a huge debate, and it was a pretty hard sell in little old Chapel Hill to get a new shelter put in.
Yep. And my understanding is that there's currently not a plan for emergency shelter. Yeah.
But is it, and so this raises another question, at what level do you attack this problem? Is it a regional, is it a local problem, is it a national problem, and what is the matrix, I guess, mm-hmm. of local, regional, and national that has to be brought to bear to bring about change?
Yeah, I think it's probably all of those things. And I know Mike can speak much more to the policy issues. I will say that there's been one, I made one discovery almost maybe a year and a half ago of this, maybe almost 2 years ago, of this great organization in Chapel Hill called the Community Empowerment Fund. And it was an organization started by UNC students who had seen the homeless people on the street and were saying, well, you know, why are these people here? And let's start talking to them and figuring this out. And they've partnered with the Self-Help Credit Union, and they sort of teach people financial literacy skills and help people become more financially empowered. But the other thing that they've paired that with is the recognition that these are people who are part of our community and they need social support. So they match undergraduate volunteers with a person who is homeless, and they provide all kinds of support. And they've got more than 80 volunteers in Chapel Hill, and they've also got a group now started in Durham. And they're really smart and compassionate and doing some really cool things. And I think that sort of seeing that kind of grassroots response, and I think we are going to have to get creative with how we address these problems.
My Nguyen, what are some of the more creative solutions that you've seen, read about, and researched that have the greatest potential?
You know, at the national level, the federal government is actually innovating in the way in which they allow local housing authorities to be more flexible in the way they use money. So there's a demonstration program currently going on called Moving to Work, and it's currently in 36 housing authorities around the country. And what that program does, it doesn't provide more money necessarily. What it does is it says, you can use your money however you think is best for your city. So if you want to spend less money on Section 8 but more money on public housing, you know, you have the flexibility to do that. And currently, that's not been the case. And so the limits on what you can do that would fit the local context has been restrictive. And so that's opening up new innovative models for the delivery of affordable housing. At a regional level, certain places are doing more regional cooperation, regional planning, creating regional housing plans. Because if you think about housing at the local level, the problems spill over to the next city. And so the idea that we're not talking to the city next to us and planning with the city next to us doesn't make any sense. We've moved in this direction with transportation planning. And I think that in this area, we need to start doing it with housing planning.
Well, tell us more about that. I mean, that's an interesting point. If I have to move out of Carrboro and I end up in Durham, I may or may not have a job. And it seems to me that kind of displacement creates some odd bubbles and pockets and some interesting problems for transportation. Tell us about that.
It creates these snowball effects. So I grew up in Orange County, California, where they've experienced tremendous housing, affordable housing pressures. And what happened was people started moving farther and farther out away from the job centers, right? So you have massive sprawl. In fact, there have been reports that have said that sprawl hits the wall, you know, in Orange County. And so that has an impact on traffic congestion, pollution, schools, all sorts of snowball effects.
And Bibi, when people are asked to, if they are asked to pay more and do, they try to stay where they are for a variety of reasons, particularly if you've had, disability changes made to your apartment or you're close to where you work or, you seek therapy or anything like that, you might want to stay. You might want to pay the extra, but that would then have an implication on your spending for food and medicine and appointments and transportation to get to appointments.
Yes, and all those things. So I think people are getting crunched from all different sides. You know, there's a for instance, there's a charity care program at UNC Healthcare, and for people who are under that, they used to have a copay of $10. That, a few years ago, went up to $35. So for people who live in extreme poverty, that is a barrier. And so they're kind of, if the costs are going up all over, but their disability income is staying the same. So I think if they chose to pay the extra rent, then they are going to have to choose not to pay for something else that is probably pretty essential, because when you're living on that little, most things are important.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Bebe Smith is a professor of social work and psychiatry at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Mai Nguyen is a professor of city and regional planning at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Colin Campbell, reporter for the News and Observer. I want to thank you all for being on the program. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Coming up next, Carrboro's Poet Laureate, Jay Bryan. Stay with us.